This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Kathy Kelly, who founded Voices in the Wilderness and is now working with Voices for Creative Nonviolence, which is carrying on for Voices in the Wilderness. She's been opposing the Iraq War even before it started, courageously speaking out against those cruel sanctions against Iraq that cost the lives of 500,000 children. She's also supported Palestinian rights. She's gone to prison for acts of civil disobedience against nuclear weapons in the School of the Americas, and she's been nominated 3 times for a Nobel Peace Prize. Kathy Kelly, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hi, Matt. It's good to be here.
It's great to see you again. How'd you get involved in peace work in the first place?
Well, I suppose I talked myself into some of it. I was working as a high school teacher, teaching religion classes, and then I was very enamored with the writings of certain people like Ammon Hennessy and Sam Day and Karl Meyer. I would use their writings in my classrooms. And at one point, I actually met Karl Meyer, and I think that we were arrested together. I remember my knees were knocking and my lip was twitching, and it wasn't because I was afraid of the police arresting us. I was afraid I'd say something really stupid in front of Karl Meyer.
This was the first time you were ever arrested?
Yeah, yeah.
And what year was that?
That would have been 1980, I think, yeah.
And do you remember the issue?
Sure. There was a renewal of a requirement that young people register for the draft. So we walked into Chicago's post office, and maybe you know the song, "They're rolling out the guns again, hooroo." Well, that echoed quite well all through the Chicago post office, and we were arrested maybe 5 times. And that occasioned the first time in front of a judge for me. And it was good to have Carl's tutelage through that process. And I think soon after that, I went to the Jesuit employers at the school where I taught and said, you know, I'd like to lower my salary beneath the taxable income. And so in a sense, the IRS was my spiritual director. You know, if you're earning any money and owning anything, you can't be a war tax refuser because the IRS will find you and they will take it. So I became pretty enamored with the possibility to do some of the things that these people that I'd read about and heard about were doing, and to do it in a community of people I just loved. And then Carl and I married each other, so it came together pretty well. We're not married at this point, but still very good friends.
And then do you remember your first act of civil disobedience that cost you a sentence that you were convicted for?
Well, we were convicted for just about everything we did. But the first time that I had a longer sentence in federal prison was for planting corn on nuclear missile silo sites. I don't know why I don't go out and do it more often, actually.
But, now, was this with Sam Day?
This was Sam Day and Bonnie Erfer and Bob Bossy, people from Milwaukee, Madison, Chicago, and very notably people in Kansas City. You know, it was almost like we'd invaded their homes and turned their homes into, you know, Catholic worker houses of hospitality. They were very, very gracious, and they saw us through a long process, inclusive of, you know, after the trials, going into the local county jails and then eventually to the prisons. And it's a privilege, really, to go back there and see that those people are still at it. They're still working hard, as are so many communities all across this country.
Isn't that the amazing thing, Kathy Kelly? That's what I notice whenever I travel, and you do a lot more traveling than I do. But there, you know, people say there's no peace movement in this country, and I just have to shake my head and disagree strenuously with that, because everywhere I go, big city, small town, there are activists, peace activists who are doing great work, not getting maybe a lot of national attention for it. But the peace movement is very much a vibrant entity right now, don't you think?
Oh, I agree. And I think that in a younger generation, there's also a great appreciation for the need to change lifestyles. And I see that happening. I mean, there are some young people in Chicago who every year now for 3 years have done a 30-day electricity fast. And, you know, they do it in the middle of winter when they can put their food out on the steps and they sit around and knit by candlelight. And
that's cold, though, yeah. In Chicago in the middle of winter without
Well,
electricity.
I admire it a lot. And there are vegan communities. There are people who are in very new and creative and dynamic ways figuring out how to just detach themselves from air travel and emphasizing much more biking, walking, gardening, local homegrown foods. And this is the kind of thing we need so much, I think.
Just to get back a second to your arrest for and sentencing, how long were you in for when you were planting flowers near a nuclear weapon?
Well, I got one of the shorter sentences. I was sentenced to a year, which I served in maximum security prison, and a wonderful chance to spend more time with Bonnie Erfer, who, if you go to prison, find someone like Bonnie to be there with, and it will go by much more quickly than imaginable. You know, that was one of the most educational years of my life since the time when I learned how to read when I was five, because there never would have been another way for me to better understand the conditions of people impoverished in this country. When you're in prison, you get a chance, not as the social worker, not as the teacher, not as the person holding forms over somebody's head or, you know, being authoritarian in it. You're just sitting on the bunk.
What were they in for, your fellow inmates there?
Most people, both then and again when I was in prison in 2004, were in for nonviolent crimes, primarily drug-related. In 2004, there were 300 people in Pekin prison, and over a fourth had sentences of 8 years or longer. And so you can imagine, you know, the first year, the second year, people might be able to stay in touch with their families. But 4, 5, 6 years into a 15-year sentence, people just begin to despair of ever getting back into the community, back into family life. And so many billions of dollars of U.S. wealth and productivity are poured into designing this still growing prison system. And of course, now we have a whole security industry, which affects our foreign policy and our domestic policy. It's as though we have to really cope with a new way of understanding war, both the war against the poor and wars waged in other countries, because of this new component. It's not just the military-industrial complex. It's the military-industrial security complex.
Or I've heard it called the military incarceration complex. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Kathy Kelly, who founded Voices in the Wilderness and is now working with its successor organization, Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Let's talk about that, Voices in the Wilderness, for a little bit, Kathy. You founded it before this Iraq war started, during the time of economic sanctions. What was the reason?
Well, you know, United Nations reports were emerging that suggested that hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children under age five were being directly punished by the economic sanctions and punished to death, brutally punished. And so we determined that if we went over to Iraq and broke the sanctions, bought medicines directly to children and families, that would be a way to dramatize our conflict. And we believe that if the United States people knew, if they knew what was happening to innocent Iraqis while Saddam Hussein wasn't necessarily missing a meal, that people would be troubled. And I think that was true. However, what I kind of glean now from much of our own organizing experience is that, okay, at the end of the day, you know how many people ever signed just a congressional letter about these horrific economic sanctions? 33. That's as far as we ever got with all of the delegations, all of the organizing, all of the many people who became involved. 33 congresspeople signed a letter. But I believe that all of that education and outreach contributed heavily toward the outpouring of resistance to the shock and awe bombardment. The world came closer to stopping a war before it started. So I think we should not lose heart when we don't make legislative gains or significant media gains. I think the outreach and the education always, in a very abiding sense, matters and is necessary. And I find that now also, when it may seem as though, you know, we just lose every single round of campaigning to stop funding for the war, and people buckle right and left, including every aspiring presidential candidate except Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul. But not to lose hope, I think that we're building these networks. And as you say, the peace movement is alive and well across this country. We might need to step up our levels of risk-taking and nonviolent resistance.
A lot of people lost hope, but lost heart after people were unable to stop the war from starting, when there were 12 million people marching all over the world to prevent it. And yet Bush and Cheney went ahead. Why didn't you lose hope then? And you were you went to Iraq at that point, didn't you?
Well, you know, you could never, ever walk away from the bedside of a child nauseated and limp and dying of hunger and say, well, it's a tough sell in the United States, so we're going to drop this issue. And now, you know, with my own memories of being in Baghdad when there were just day after day, morning and afternoon and night, ear-splitting explosions and sickening thuds, and knowing that people were pureed under those direct hits, being at the hospital bedsides of people whose bodies were torn apart, children who were mangled because of direct hits, being with people after the war, traumatized as they were, and the disappointment people felt when they realized that the only building the U.S. was going to protect was the oil ministry, that the looting was just stampeding across the city. Never, never, never could I walk away from those issues and say, well, it's too hard.
Must have been dangerous for you to be there when those bombs were falling, though, wasn't it, Kathy Kelly?
You know, I think that we were very united and determined in a belief that even though we wanted so much to stop a war that we completely believed was wrongful, we also knew that where you stand determines what you see, and we felt that we should stand with people in front of the guns and not just be, you know, on the other side behind the guns. And I think if you're behind the guns when you go to war, then you're kind of complicit for the shooting. So it was almost a relief to spend that terrible time with people that we'd gotten to know very well and to be able to at least reassure that we wouldn't walk away from them at that point.
Got to admire for doing that. That's took incredible courage, it seems to me. I mean, I was sitting here in Madison, Wisconsin, doing my writing. It didn't take a lot to do that. Tell me where you think things are right now with the Iraq war and the Iraq occupation.
It seems to me that the desire on the part of major corporations to continue being beneficiaries is of the war profiteering is continuing with very little interference. I mean, I think that's where we see that aspiring presidential candidates, people already in elected office, people who want to be elected, they're very frightened of interfering with the money-making that goes on amongst the major bigs. I'm thinking of Raytheon, Halliburton, Kellogg, Brown & Root, General Dynamics, Boeing, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman. And yet, you know, it's good to look over to, for instance, Ireland, where a small group of very sturdy activists have now racked up two court cases wherein they were acquitted on all charges for doing significant damage, in one case to a United States Navy warplane parked on the tarmac of Shannon Airport, and in a second case, a Raytheon factory and corporate headquarters for that company, that Raytheon making the bunker busters. And the juries acquitted them. And I think that we may feel like, well, we can't do very much, so then we don't do anything at all. But I think all of us can keep on trying to do what we can do in terms of outreach and education, in terms of going to the offices of elected representatives and insisting that we never should have gone to this war in the first place. So the idea of talking about honor or victory or success in the wake of the wreckage and the damage that's been inflicted on a country that meant us no harm, a war of choice that we waged, if anything, we should be paying reparations, and not through the auspices of these major greedy corporations, but rather recognize that the United Nations, quite a significant number of non-governmental organizations, do have ways to help to alleviate the terrible humanitarian crisis that continues both within Iraq, where, just to name the number of people displaced by the war, 2.2 million people displaced because they had to flee their homes, flee death threats, flee explosions.
Excuse me for interrupting. Are these people internal refugees?
Yes, internally displaced persons, and some living in deplorable camp kinds of conditions where outbreaks of cholera have already begun again this summer, some squeezing in with relatives, some living in new shanty towns that have developed. Then you have to recognize Syria, that's taken in 1.5 million Iraqis. Compare that to the number the United States has taken. We've maybe just gone toward 5,000, I think. Then Jordan, another impoverished country, not as badly off as Syria and an ally of the United States, but they've taken in at least now close to 500,000 refugees, and the United States should be the ones.
Now, you've
that
spent
are
some time
these
with
people.
These refugees, right?
Well, in Jordan, particularly for me, I've sat in primitive living conditions, one-room houses where people squeeze into the same room for their sleeping quarters as their living quarters, and you know, a substandard latrine and bad plumbing, faulty water systems. And these are people who had pretty well-to-do middle-class lifestyles in Iraq. But when they've come to Jordan, increasingly in recent years, they're out of resources, maybe because they paid a ransom. And actually, some of those very families that paid a ransom, you know, in one case, a young teenager, 16 years old, was being hung by his ankle from the ceiling while tormentors who kidnapped him, he's an Iraqi youngster, were tormenting him with electric prods. He was screaming, and they had a cell phone so that the parents were hearing this. So Rami's parents, of course, they sold everything. They raced in 4 days to amass all the money they could from relatives and friends, and they freed their child. They were told that their case was questionable because of credibility in terms of entering the United States, because why had they paid a ransom?
So the idea that they couldn't get asylum here, when the condition for asylum is usually that you have a credible case that you may be persecuted if you return to your home country. I mean, that is, should be an open and shut case in this circumstance.
But so many times the people paid ransoms, then they're in this questionable category because maybe they gave support to insurgents. At any rate, it doesn't seem to win hearts and minds that the United States Embassy has just been so hard-nosed in its interviews with refugees who feel that they've been treated in humiliating and dismissive ways. And certainly when you look at how much money does the United States give toward humanitarian concerns, the International Organization of Migration that works with the State Department is quite clear that what the United States spends on humanitarian concerns is 0.01% on a daily basis of what we spend on the military. So of course you're going to have more foot soldiers joining militias. They don't have any income. They can't feed their families. And, you know, they're told, well, you can get $300 a month if you tell the U.S. you'll tote one of their AK-47s and sit at a checkpoint. So the United States, I think, is exacerbating the possibility of renewed or ongoing civil war by loading up different tribal groups or different religious sects with more and more weapons and ammunition, and saying that by paying them off to not shoot now, there's some guarantee for a long-term future peace.
That's not how it's being sold here, though. I mean, we're being told that the war is over virtually, that, you know, the United States has achieved a victory here, and that the government of Iraq is stable and can withstand anything at this stage, and you don't seem to agree with that.
I think it's always helpful to just imagine, what if what Iraq was famous for was its asparagus? If Iraq grew asparagus, would we be there? I think that the victory that McCain and the Republicans want is one in which they can claim honor and success in being able to dominate energy resources in a part of the world where there is abundant energy resource. But that's not going to help us through the crisis we're in right now with global warming, depletion of fossil fuels, climate changes that are really quite frightening, and our over-consumptive and wasteful patterns of life. We need leadership, and I'm not sure the Democrats will be up for it. We need leadership that will help guide us into changing our own lifestyles to be more compatible with the realities of the planet we inhabit.
I'm speaking with Kathy Kelly, who founded Voices in the Wilderness and is now with Voices for Creative Nonviolence, the successor group. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Kathy Kelly, you're visiting here in Madison, Wisconsin, as you are on a march from Chicago to St. Paul, a Witness Against War march. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the reasons we decided we wanted to take this walk through Wisconsin was because we learned that the Red Brigade, the 32nd Combat Unit of National Guard troops, is on alert for a call-up for combat duty in Iraq in 2009. And we felt that by walking through residential areas, through towns and villages, and distributing leaflets and having opportunities for various interviews and carrying our signs, we'd be able to help alert people in Wisconsin to this reality and also We want to continue to say that both the Democrats and the Republicans should be held responsible for this war, for getting us into it and for ending it. And Chicago has some notoriety because of the Democratic National Convention that was held during the height of the Vietnam War. And so we thought the walk between Chicago and then St. Paul, the site of the Republican National Convention, would give us a bit more of a platform to say that we hold both of these entities responsible and also certainly average ordinary people. And then we think, you know, the means you use determines the end you get. And all of us have felt as though we've been too consumptive of fuel in transportation in our normal modes, whether it's in travel by car or by plane. There's something very good in just walking every day and remembering that, you know, after a week, you've walked pretty far. You've covered a good distance.
How are you being received?
I'm surprised at the vigor of some of the positive shout-outs that we get along the road. I've done a walk similar to this through Illinois 2 years ago, and there were a lot of honks, and people would stick their thumbs out of the windows, but people are just raising a fist and saying, go, yeah, we're with you. So that's encouraging. I'm pleased when somebody actually stops, and especially if they can get into a dialogue with the young man who is an Iraq veteran against war, Paul Melling, a very compelling, unassuming young man who spent 14 months with troops in Fallujah, and speaks about his own experiences of not really knowing why he was over there, of being troubled as an artilleryman, that they just kept firing round after round after round of shots into civilian areas, even though it was pretty evident that whoever might have fired at them first probably had a mobile Katusha rocket firer and was long gone. He was troubled by the fact that they were ordered every night, take all the uneaten food and all the unopened food, truckfuls, Humvees loaded with food, and go to a local dump site and burn it all, while people, Iraqi people, were hungering to the point of malnourishment.
That's a story I'd never heard about before. That's kind of horrifying.
Yeah, in fact, Kelly Doherty at first told that to me, and she's now the chair of Iraq Vets Against War, and she said that when she would ask her superiors, why are we doing this? You know, they would be burning her loads of food on roadsides in front of Iraqis in full view, and they'd say, well, if we just leave it out there, the Iraqis will fight over it. As though any Boy Scout troop couldn't organize that number, you know?
That's about the paternalistic attitude of the war makers encapsulated, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We've got to stay there because things would be worse if we're not there. We can't even hand out food because they don't know. They won't be able to distribute their own food. That's pathetic. Kathy Kelly, you also have been involved in this issue of Palestinian rights, and you spent some time in refugee camps there on the West Bank. What's that been like?
You know, I remember one time walking into the Jenin camp when it was under siege, and we really had to talk our way in. And it was so interesting to be with people mostly younger than me who could talk with the Israeli Defense Force soldiers about pop music. And I might have talked about novels, and another was an expert on scripture and talked about the Old Testament. And we had fascinating conversations. You'd want to catch up with any one of these young people over a beer later. And yet they kept on telling us, I am not responsible. I'm only doing my job. And some of the older Israeli Defense Force soldiers would kind of wince because they knew that those lines came directly out of the Eichmann trials and Hannah Arendt's writing. And then we were told repeatedly, look, we know you're concerned about what's going on inside the Jenin camp, but there are no women or children there. There's only bad guys there. You hear this bad guy language coming from our soldiers in Iraq now, too. Well, when we got inside the camp, I mean, the first day we were trying to help pull a grandmother who was paralyzed from the waist down out from under the half of her building that was complete rubble while her relatives kind of fed her through a window. And when we got her out of the building, she was terrified of us. We didn't speak any Arabic. She didn't know who we were. And so I remember my friend said, Kathy, run and get a stretcher. And I thought, well, where? And I just peeled off thinking I might have remembered some kind of Red Cross sign, running down a road. And three Israeli soldiers were running toward me. And I, you know, sometimes it helps to have been a high school study teacher. I said, just put those guns down now. And they did. They put the guns down. And And I asked them, look, I need to know where the emergency room entrance is, and I'm all confused. And they showed me exactly how to get there. And so then I was running back with the stretcher on my head, and Jeff Gunzel, for the voices person I was with, was crouched over the grandmother, and he was waving his blue passport in the air, saying, "American, American." And above, from a second-story balcony, Israeli Defense Force soldiers were hurling plates and glasses and cups down on the grandmother. So you see the confusion that war brings. It's just this utter confusion. If it's the bad guys, then, you know, ransack the apartments, break the dishes, shoot the rubber bullets, let loose with the tear gas, and sometimes shoot to kill. And yet, at the same time, if you can have an interesting conversation about Andre Schwarzwald's novel, The Last of the Just, with an American, that's fine. So we're involved in this as people from the United States as well, this kind of desire to be the good guys and yet complicit behavior with the bad guys again and again and again. And, you know, I don't want to use that brushstroke too widely, but I think that it's very difficult for us to come to grips with our responsibility. I remember seeing a woman holding a child's hand as she walked past the wreckage of what was her home. And she came over to me, and a Palestinian woman jabbed me in the shoulder. And I've never heard this before. She said, "Put this in your notebook. It is you that we hold responsible. It is you who have caused this, you Americans." And I thought to myself, how would I ever communicate that back to people in the United States? They don't know Janine. They don't know Janine Camp. They don't know that the United States has contributed toward Israel having 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons. They don't know the experience of the people in the West Bank under occupation. But nevertheless, that is our responsibility, to try to educate U.S. people to see how we're seen by other people around the world, and to connect our security, our, quote, national security, directly with those perceptions. Because the more people see us as the feared imperial menace, the less safe and secure we actually are.
What hope do you have on this issue of Israel and Palestine? You talked about the Iraq war with Democrats and Republicans. It seems to me it's even trickier to imagine that either presidential aspirant is going to change things without a lot of pushing from us.
Well, that's certainly true. I think the facts on the ground change demographically, population changes, and I myself keep open to the possibility of a one-state solution in Israel's future. But I think the people who should be taking the greatest risks are the Israeli peace movement and the U.S. peace movement. You can't expect the Palestinians to be organizing risk-taking nonviolence beyond what they're already doing. And in Beilin, it's quite magnificent, I think. If they aren't finding parallel pushes, nonviolent resistance happening in Europe and in the United States and amongst the Israeli peace movement, we could all take greater risks.
We're going to have to leave it at that. That is a good message to take to heart, though. Kathy Kelly has been my guest today. She's the founder of Voices in the Wilderness, now working with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. What's the website there?
Oh, www.vcnv.org. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy, so much for being my guest today.
Great to be here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.